all, you know. It's, and so I went in and talked to this family, and I said, you know, tell me about Bubba. And they were kind of quiet, and they didn't say anything. And so I thought, well, I'll ask if, you know, did he like to do anything? And it was still kind of quiet. And finally, one of them said, he liked to watch TV. It's a start. It's a start. He liked to watch TV. Okay, let's go with it. Now, the character traits that you and I have, they display themselves by relationships. So how do we know God? We're in a relationship with Him. We come to His Word. Something that someone says tells us a lot of their character traits, right? We come to see them and know them and understand them, and so we begin to get those things. So God's character is not really, though it's not not explicitly stated in the Bible, you can pretty easily find it, see it, read it, know of it, and come to a pretty strong conclusion, okay, this is the character of God. Now I need to align myself with the character of God. So sin is not necessarily breaking a commandment, though that might be sin, but sin is walking away from the character of God. I've got, I noticed the stack is a little small. I am glad to see that. A free book there called More Than Words, The Moral Value of Music, or the moral, I can't remember what I said there when I was trying to argue, can music itself be sinful? Well, what's the character of God? Would God like this music? Does this music make God dance? What does this music do? So a thought, a word, a deed, or an omission that is against the revealed character of God. Now, our world, not necessarily the theological world, but the secular world we live in, really has decided over the last 50 years or so that there is not an objective standard for right or wrong. Everything becomes situational. In fact, for a time, we even talked about situational ethics. As we saw this coming about, I don't hear that term very much anymore, but in our world today, there's definitely a, well, what's right for the situation? What's right for the society? It becomes very hard to determine what is sin, and that may be one of the reasons why the Presbyterian Church hangs an LGBT flag and, you know, all this kind of stuff, that they have rejected the idea that we look to the character of God. We find the character of God both by nature, general revelation, and by specific revelation. Now, an indicator that it's a sin, if you're trying to figure out, is this sin, would it dishonor God? That's a pretty good indicator, right? This is not something I would do in God's presence. This is not something that I think that God would be pleased with. This is not something that I could say this reflects the character of God. And a lot of things in there that we could take and say, okay, because God would be uncomfortable with this, I am going to be uncomfortable with this. I am going to say, I think that actually gets sinful. It's against the character of God. Does it break God's law? That's a pretty good indicator right there, isn't it? Now, we do have to be careful, of course, because we take the Bible dispensationally, and we know that God did have certain rules and regulations that were for certain times with His people. Is it rooted in unbelief? That really comes down to God and the character of God. And does it fail to do that which is right? Right, of course, is the nickname for righteous. So we look at the character of God. Now, I do want to talk a little bit about sin versus evil versus temptation. And this is my own kind of definitions here. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work. But sin, let's start with temptation, actually. Temptation is the opportunity to sin. It is not sin itself, but you have an opportunity that lays in front of you. In fact, it's an opportunity that you kind of want to do, right? And you look at that and say, okay, does this match the character of God? No, it doesn't match the character of God. Should I go ahead and do it anyway? There you're tempted, right? You might even say, well, no, I shouldn't go ahead and do it anyway, but I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway. You're getting in the area of transgression, right? Now, at this point, or the opportunity to sin is only temptation. I find nothing in the scripture that teaches us, if we take a literal point of view, that teaches us it is sin, or even that you are sinful because you are tempted. I suppose you could find or create temptation just about anywhere you go, right? Easy to find, okay, this is not the character of God, and carry that out. So temptation is the opportunity to sin. Sin becomes the willful choice. The willful choice to make this moral contradiction. Here's the character of God. Here's what I'm going to do. I am going to live in a way that contradicts the character of God. And I think that we really have to bring the idea of a willful contradiction in. That is, you chose to do it. Now, probably we could argue you chose in your subconscious to do it. You chose 30 years ago to do it. It's so much a part of who you are now. There's some of those things that we could bring in where we don't every time we fall into temptation or submit to temptation, every time we don't go through a thought process that that we know how this works, but ultimately that is when we sin. Now, evil, I'm going to put into a broader category. Evil is almost, in a sense, the result of sin. It's the leftovers of sin. It's the exhaust pipe for sin, right? It's the calamity. It's the destruction that is left in the wake of your sin. So we live in an evil world. I don't have a problem saying that. I don't think you have a problem saying that, especially if you're from Fresno. So we live in an evil world. What does that mean? Well, it means there's a lot of the effects of sin that are around us. We can see the leftovers. We can see the garbage that is there. And so you've got calamity. You've got the judgment of sin. And in fact, the Lord even says sometimes, he says, if you, the nation, typically, if the nation goes off, if it doesn't repent, if it doesn't come back to me, I am going to send judgment down in the form of the Amalekites or whatever it's going to be. I'm going to send judgment upon the nation. And then sometimes it'll go a little bit later, and he'll say, I will not repent of the evil that I am about to do. That is the judgment that comes down, the calamity that is about to be given. So evil, I'm going to take that as that effect that comes from sin. There's some evil in your life because society has sinned, right? Or individuals in society, there's all the leftover. There's some evil in your life because you have sinned. Calamity, some judgment that came down, some things that you have to begin to live with. So sin is personal. We're going to talk a little bit about sin is not societal. Individual sin. They willfully sin. Sin is personal. It is an accountable violation of God's character and God's will. So the child that, let's see, has Mabel got to the point yet of saying no? Probably not. Oh, maybe she has. She's old enough. Mine. Mama comes first and no comes second. And a child will begin to display some selfishness. Now, I'm going to say that child is not sinning. That child is protecting her own interest, right? You might say, well, selfishness is against the character of God. But what that child doesn't have is a personal, accountable violation of character and will. There's no ability to guide through this and think through that. It's much more of a natural thing that is taking place within that child. Now, where did sin come from? I think it's important to remind ourselves that sin did not come from our heart. Sin did not come from Adam's heart, as a matter of fact. Sin did not come from, in sin my mother conceived me, and this is why sin's, where did sin come from? Sin first appears in heaven. Think about it a little bit. From everything we know about Satan, by the way, I am skipping, you may already know, I'm going to skip the chapter on angelology. I'm not going to teach it here because I'm going to teach it at the Taos Bible Conference, formerly known as the Taos Prophecy Conference, which is the last weekend of this month, 20-ish. 26th, 27th, 28th. Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You still have time to make it to Taos. I think we have one bedroom left in our free, let's see, somebody can stay in the camper. And after that, you're up to hotel rooms, okay? If you'd like to come, we're gonna spend Friday night, Saturday morning, and conclude on Sunday with talking about the unseen realm, angels and demons in there. So I am gonna have to skip that chapter. I when I wrote the chapter, I started writing, and I thought, oh, I don't know how much, you know, what do we really know about angels and demons? I don't know. That's good when you're starting to write the chapter, right? I don't have a clue what we know. Then the more I worked on an outline and did research, I'm like, whoa, this is beginning to get a long chapter. How in the world am I ever going to fit this in? And then I thought, September, that's how I'm going to fit it in. So that chapter is going to wait till the Taos Prophecy Conference. But sin, getting back to sin, it happened in heaven. Not in Eden. We think of the origin of sin as Genesis chapter 3. This is where sin came about. But it came from a prideful rebellion of an angelic being. Now, if you can be in heaven as an angel in the presence of God and sin develops, that has to tell you that sin is not really a product of the environment, right? If we just had the right environment, if we had a better educational system and kinder, gentler people all around us, then sin wouldn't be there, right? Well, sin comes about in heaven. Isaiah chapter 14 talks about the king of Babylon. A number of weeks ago in the Little Bit of This, Little Bit of That series on Sunday mornings, I gave a study of the Isaiah 14 passage a little more, and to make the long story short of that particular study, I said Isaiah 14 actually is about, it's the one that uses the term Lucifer, or it eventually got translated into Lucifer, light bearer was the Hebrew word, and that got into Latin as Luciferi, the one who brings light. And then that we named our children after. From there, we began to say Satan's name is Lucifer. Now, I got into all of that in that particular series, but the first thing I said is, this is really about the king of Babylon. It tells us right there, it's about the king of Babylon. So from the strictest biblical literalist view, Isaiah 14 is about the king of Babylon. But when you read Isaiah 14 about the king of Babylon, you begin to say, I think this is more than the king of Babylon here. I think this is a reflection of something. What in the world is it? And you make, I think, a good conclusion to say, hey, this is about the guy that now, from that story, we call him Lucifer. By the way, I mentioned this not too long ago as well. Some of the older people remember the rich man and Lazarus. He's often called Dives back in the old days. Dives and Lazarus. Dives is just the Latin for rich man, I believe. So we began to call him Dives. Well, it's the same way. We didn't know what his name was. We still don't know what his name is. He's Satan, the adversary. He's an angel of light, or he's a light bearer. But we call him light bearer. We call him Lucifer. So when we read this, we have to say, hey, that I think this is about more than the king of Babylon here. Literally reading, I can literally tell you, there is more than meets the eye right here. This is shouting out something else. And so we make a doctrinal conclusion. I think we're right, but we make a doctrinal conclusion. Okay, this is the king of Babylon who says, I will ascend, I will be like the Most High. Okay, This is sin coming about. Ezekiel 28, again, the king of Tyrus. The king of Tyrus is about the king of Tyrus, but here the king of Tyrus is described as being in Eden. He's described as being perfect in beauty. He's described as later fallen from his pride. Revelation 12, again, talks about the heavenly rebellion that will come, but sin comes in seeing the character of God and saying, that should be me instead of him, robbing God of his character, rooted then in self-exaltation. So sin is not an environment. It is a volitional act of rebellion that in this case was taken, displayed in the king of Tyre and the king of Babylon in Lucifer. And there is that angelic rebellion is the origin of sin. Now, what about for the human race? Where did we come into sin? Of course, we know that to be Genesis chapter 3. The serpent comes. We don't even know who the serpent is when you just read chapter 3. Here's this serpent. He's more subtle than all the beasts of the field. And he comes and he begins to cast doubt on God's word. Hath God really said? And Eve, I think it's very interesting, Eve is deceived. Adam is the guy that makes the willful decision. You got snookered. I'm going to go along with it. I'm going to take the fruit. And so when we see here, down here, I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit and then back up. Adam becomes the legal entry point. In Adam all sinned. We could have a fun discussion with this someday, but even in, 1 Corinthians chapter 11 that talks about a woman's head covering, again, not the thing on up here, but her husband, it says, hey, here's the reason, because Eve was deceived. Since Eve was deceived, she gets to be under a man who willfully chose to sin. be a fun discussion there, but because of that, I do think we need to stop and think, because sometimes there really is just such a total deception that even though we would say that is a sinful act, I think God might be saying, you got snookered. That was deception. That's not good for you. But would we even call that sin? You say, no, that's, when I'm deceived and I do it, it's my problem. I might say, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. that second time, that's, okay, I'm not deceived anymore. The reason I would be pretty strong on that, unless convinced otherwise. The reason I'd be pretty strong on that is you may remember that there was an entire nation that was deceived about their Messiah, and that Messiah hanging on the cross said what? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Don't hold this to their charge. This is not against them. They got deceived. Now, if we could have a longer discussion there, it's hard to have a long discussion with someone who's dying. But if we could have a longer discussion, I kind of would like to say, what about the chief priests that stirred all this up and knew exactly what they are doing? Are you including them in that, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do? I don't know how far that goes, but be an interesting conversation someday. Now, sin, not so much eating the fruit, it was violating the command of God. Now, the command of God happened to be eating the fruit, so that's a little bit of circular reasoning there. But sin brought about some things immediately. This violating God's clear command, which violates obviously his character, brought some results. One of them, the very first one we see, is shame. I'm pretty sure that we could argue, and if I was going to study, anyone here a psychology major or anything like that? Do we have any psychos? If I was going to go into the world of psychology, that's the issue that I would work on right there is shame. I might even go to virtually everything when they come in and lay on the couch there and I start the clock. I might even say, your problem is shame. Now let's get to it. Let's figure it out. Okay, let's figure it out. What are you ashamed of? What led to that? What were you trying to cover up? What were you trying to hide? Shame is so much the motivator in who... Now shame is not a sin. Shame is the result of sin that we deal with. It's an effect of sin. Related to that, fear, hiding, broken fellowship, blame. We saw that immediately with Adam as well, didn't we? We saw the broken fellowship, you know, God, him hiding right there. The fear of God. I was naked, and so I hid myself. And ultimately, the reign of death. All these things come about as a result of sin coming into the world. Now, this occurred, of course, in the dispensation of innocence. Once again, I want to bring up, Adam and Eve were not struggling with a society around them. It was not an environmental kind of thing. They were in the Garden of Eden and they sinned. So the first two times we see sin has nothing to do with the environment that was around them. And... I'm an advocate of homeschooling and living in the mountains and all that kind of stuff. But guess what? If you homeschool your children, they will never have sin in their life. Because you will keep them away from those sinful influences and they will be pure as the driven snow. Wrong. You know, it doesn't matter if you've got the perfect home environment and you live, 85 miles to the closest center and you don't allow them on the property. Sin, it's an inside thing that comes even in the dispensation of innocence. And they failed that one little test of obedience, and so sin came in, not originating with Adam, but entering the human race through Adam, or the first sin, of course, in Adam. Now, getting back to deception, the serpent came, put forth the temptation, Eve was deceived, Adam bears the ultimate responsibility. Let's try 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 14 here. And I think it's under there. One, Timothy. You should redo Biblify so that it gets typos and understands what I'm trying to say. Yes, you should just make it read my mind. Voice activated. There we go. Oh, I've even highlighted it in the past. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in transgression. Notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing. Oh, that gets into interesting stuff there. But again, it's clear. Adam was not deceived. The woman was deceived. And it is in Adam... Romans 5:12, in Adam, sin was introduced to the world. Why not in Eve? You know, it's a moot point because it didn't happen, but it makes you wonder, what if Adam had said, no, Eve, you've taken this because you were deceived, but that's not what we do. I'm not going to do it. Would God have just kicked out Eve? I don't know, but I kind of think not. Eve was deceived. Adam was responsible. Adam was given the word, but Adam did have a conscious rebellion. No ignorance, no deception. And so 1 Corinthians 15:22, in Adam all die. and death came into the world and spread universally. Those who didn't sin after the similitude of Adam, they also died. So it's Adam's unique act that introduced sin and death. But each person remains accountable for their own response to God. We're going to talk about the consequences of sin and iron out how exactly that happens in just a moment. Now, still talking about the origins of sin, God is not the author of sin. We know this. God is the standard that determines what sin is, but He's not the author of sin. Sin is not eternal. There was a beginning of sin, and there is going to be an end of sin. No more sin. So sin is a temporary part of the existence we have. It's not part of God's nature, and ultimately God's nature is going to display itself from top to bottom, through and through, like it did in the past and will in the future. But sin, one of the things it does is prove free will. Angels sinned without temptation. Adam sinned with no compulsion. We look at sin, we look at the temptation, we decide what we're going to do. We have a moral agency that is real, and that moral agency that is real is what brings about a responsibility. So, that being the origin of sin, let's talk a little bit about the nature of sin, and three things especially: personal, volitional, and moral. I'm going to put those three things down to say, here's what sin is. It's personal, it's volitional, and it is moral. First of all, personal. Sin is committed by individuals. We talk sometimes about a sinful humanity. Sinful humanity. That probably is Reformed theology, Calvinist talk. There are sinful humans, what we have. Society doesn't really sin. Sin is committed by individuals. Now, sometimes there is corporate guilt because one person sinned, or consequences, or even an accumulation of personal disobedience that stacks up until there are people you've run across them in their life. Some of you may have broken free from this in your own lives, where a family is so in the habit of living a life of sin that the child, the grandchild, the great-grandchild are almost captivated by sin from the very time they're born. And some people call that a generational sin, something like this, and breaking the curse of generational sin. The curse of generational sin is just, for generations, my family been sinning, and all sinning kind of in the same neighborhood, and that became the environment, that became the training, that became the deception, but then that became the willful manner in which we've gone through, and so there becomes a corporate guilt, if you will, but it's not that the family sins, it's the individuals personally sin. We were having a discussion after the last session, I think it was, in which we talked about unreached people groups and even the cavemen that are out there. Okay, where'd these cavemen come from? Where'd these unreached people groups come from? They really came from one person making a decision and another and another and another generation and another generation and another generation. And eventually you get so far from knowledge. You know, had a discussion with someone else too about ancient man, and maybe did they know some things that we've forgotten since then, like how did they build the pyramids, all that kind of stuff. Who was I talking with about that? I forgot. Somebody from Iowa knows these things. And let's suppose for just a moment that ancient man had engineering knowledge far beyond where our knowledge maybe even is today, and somehow we forgot it. How in the world can you just forget all that stuff? Well, it's really not all that hard, is it? One generation quits using it, the next generation quits using it. I mean, we see all the time little, on social media or something, you might see a picture of some antique and people say, what is this? You know, anybody know what this is? And the vast majority of people under 92 look at it and they're like, I have no clue what that is. I don't know what that is. You find out it's a cream separator or something. I don't know. It's a cassette tape. That's right. It actually doesn't take long to forget something. Well, you can do the same thing with knowledge. For whatever reason, you set that aside, you reject that. You can do the same thing with God. One person rejects it, and then they move away. They move away from the rest of them, and they have children. Their children never know about it. And maybe even, in fact, I have this friend. I'll go ahead and call him a friend. His name is Joel. And Joel comes to Taos every now and then, and I see him, and he's kind of a hippie. He's a hippie. And he's also a little bit of a surfer. He's a surfer hippie. How's that? In Taos, yes. But he spends his winters in Hawaii, and he comes in Taos in the summer. And the thing I like about surfer hippies is they don't mind climbing trees and cutting branches out of the top. And so I know him, and every now and then I call up on him, and we get his mail at the church because he has no address. And so I was like, ah, send it here. Every now and then, I get something. It's like, I'll tell him he's got mail. When he comes, he can pick it up. What did that have to do? Oh, yeah. So Joel told me, and I was a little bit half jealous, not completely. He lived in a cave in Hawaii for 5 years. And now he decided to come back to civilization a little bit. But that didn't always happen. Sometimes you live in a cave with a woman for 5 years and you have babies and they live in a cave. You get used to living in a cave, and before long you've got cavemen, right? This is who they are. This is the lifestyle that they live. And, even our society today could make some decisions that would decide, hey, we don't like this anymore. There's even a lot of things, good or bad, and I should go over here and push the clock that I have to do now that Renee and Michael's gone. Make sure I'm good on time. But there's a lot of things in our society that I notice that younger people are rejecting. They're really not that interested in that in their life. Rich and I talk sometimes about how when we were young, we couldn't wait to get the car keys and we couldn't wait to get out the door. Sorry, Mom. But we wanted to be out and gone, lickety-split, soon as we could, and we wanted to buy a hot rod and then fall in love and get married and have a house and a picket fence and a bigger house and two cars. And I see a lot of young people today are saying, nah, I'm not interested in that. I don't want that. I just want to live and let live, right? A much more easygoing, laid-back kind of lifestyle in a younger generation. Okay, it doesn't take long until you lose a sense or an attitude. I'm not saying that the way we did it was right, but you lose a sense or attitude. A society moves away from something. Now, that adds up one way or another. And on that particular illustration, by the way, I don't know that one way was sinful and the other way not sinful. I'm just saying you develop a corporate results from that. Societal results from that. Here's the payback that comes from that, whether it be good or bad. And here we're talking about sin. So you've got this accumulation of personal disobedience that comes one after another. By the way, if you come from a family that has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 generations of horse thieves, the only way to get out of that is decide, I'm not going to be a horse thief. It's a personal decision, or I'm going to get shot, like Dad and Grandpa and Great Grandpa and all of the rest of them. There's a solution. It's not that you need curse the demon of horse thievery, whatever it is. It's you need to decide, That's not what I'm going to do. I move away from that. I quit. So sin is personal. Sin is volitional, really does have a choice. Maybe if we wanted, I know somebody might want to say, I think there's a lot of sin that you didn't really make the choice. You just ended up there. You sort of slid into it a little bit. I'll even give it for you in a moment. I don't want to. But I'll even give it, okay, so there's a little bit of sin that you got into that you never willfully decided. You were deceived and then you ended up, accidentally, by deception, you ended up staying there. But even if we give that, which I don't think we need to, but even if we give that, I think you and I would agree, it is such a sliver of the sin pie that it's almost not worth talking about. The sin that you and I got in, we got in there because we decided to do it, right? Along the way, somewhere, consciously or subconsciously, we're making a decision. And so there is a volitional act. James chapter 1, verse 14 talks about how, sin comes about when there's temptation and it goes to seed. And eventually, there is the decision, there is the will, there is the action that takes place. And so you come with deception that may distort. But even when you're deceived, the responsibility, it was yours. You decided somewhere, okay, I am going to go in and begin to do that. And then sin is moral. That is, it's a breach of God's character. It's a divine standard. Now, I say that because sometimes, let's see, what illustration can I do and not get myself in trouble? There are words that society has said you're not supposed to say that anymore. That's why we have the Washington Commanders. Or the Cleveland Guardians. But someday it'll be sinful to be a guardian. And they'll have to change to the Cleveland Clavettes. Something.
It's just a sin being Cleveland.
Yeah, we grow these things that the elementary school I went to, we were the Chelwood Chiefs, but it can't be Chiefs anymore. So now there's something like I think they're the Chipmunks. Watch out. Girl with a BB gun out there. But anyway, those things are, let's call them societal norms. You break a societal norm, that is not a sin. Some would say it's a sin to drink out of a plastic bottle, right? Then others, was that already open? Did you drink out of that, Steve? Oh, you opened it for me. I got little tiny plastic things in my esophagus. Those, to go against a societal norm is, it may be rude, crude, and socially unacceptable, but that's not sin. Sin is based upon the character of God. So that's the word I mean when I put it is moral. It is objective. And the thing that is measured against, by the way, just in case you're not in construction, do you know what that is?
Plumb
a plumb line, good. A plumb line keeps things straight. see how I got that wall going there. It's the image of a plumb line. Thank you. It's the image and a likeness of a plumb line. The plumb line is the character of God. The divine standard, God is the standard. We put Him as the we measure up against Him. Let's see, Tim, you hang wallpaper, right? Do you hate wallpaper with stripes? Well, you're probably good. Plaid or stripes, yeah. That's my one wallpaper hanging experience had stripes, and I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't call the professional. And I started at this end and made it straight according to the wall. And I got over here and I said, we got to get a silk tree.
Not
It was straight all the way up until the end. If you measure sin based upon what the preacher said, you measure sin based upon what society said, what the school system says, whatever, you're gonna run yourself ragged, for one. You can liberate yourself from some of that. Now, I'm not saying you should ignore every societal norm. Sometimes there's good reason that we have decided some things societally, but that's not sin that has to be done and has to be taken care of. I probably shouldn't talk about this because I'm Baptist and I have too many in a Baptist audience, but drinking. Is it card playing? Baptists only do dominoes. Dancing. Pool playing.
Chewing tobacco.
All these things that we put as this is a sin. You know, I'm probably going to hell because I chewed tobacco. And Herbert Hoover, by the way, was quite worried about that. The Republican Party at the time wanted to go a wet policy against prohibition, and he was dry. And as a matter of fact, do you know, he might have lost the election not because of the Great Depression, but because of the prohibition issue.
Oh, for sure.
Kind of hard telling, but that's where they made the money. Okay. What have you got? It's a moral standard. Personal, volitional, moral. I think we ought to avoid determinism, which really reduces sin to destiny. This is in the cards. This is the person they are. This is what they're born under. This is their nature. Did someone say something? And we ought to avoid relativism, in which sin is a cultural, emotional, not divine. So each sinner, that's you, is a moral agent, fully responsible for their choosing disobedience. Now, we talked last time about our nature. Let's talk about our nature as it relates to sin. What have we inherited? Are we sinful? I am convinced that sin is not a biological or a metaphysical condition that is passed down. Sin is not something you get from your mother or your father. Even if you have a sinful mother or father, it is sin is personal, volitional, and moral. So you are not born a sinner, as we are so often taught. I don't think the Bible teaches that you are born a sinner. Sin is not a biological problem, which if you make sin a nature problem, then that's a biological problem. You have it because you were born human. Sin is not a disease in the bloodstream or an essence embedded in human nature. Really, I just said the same thing. If sin is a blood problem, like sometimes we try to teach again with the virgin birth that I talked about yesterday, if sin is a blood problem and we just need no dad because that's where the blood problem, it becomes a biological issue, and maybe we could get a vaccine for it or something like this, right? To take care of it. It's a DNA problem, and really, total depravity or original sin is a, it's a DNA issue. In fact, they will say that total depravity affects even the physical body, that the physical body is depraved, so it's a bloodstream problem. That if it is a bloodstream problem, I think we ought to get some Kennedy on it. There we go. If sin were inherited, like eye color, I was talking to Miles the other day, and he said, out of the blue, "I have blue eyes," out of the blue. And I said, "I do too." And he said, "Well, that's because of genetics." Okay, part of that conversation was true. If sin were inherited like eye color, it would be structural. Pity. You know, I don't know if pity is the right word because it has a little negative connotations, but you see someone who's born maybe with spina bifida or Down syndrome or something, and there's a sorrow that goes out that we have for them because this is a nature problem, this is a biological problem, this is a genetic problem that they have. If sin is like that, then sin is a problem to be pitied. Poor me, poor you. We were born with this DNA problem. It's a structural problem. And do we judge someone that is born, let's say, with a mental deficiency? What would you think if we spoke very rudely to someone who was hired, it was a help out to someone who maybe had Down syndrome, and you treated them like dirt because they couldn't handle what you were saying, or they couldn't speak very clearly. You saw someone doing that, you would come to the person's defense, wouldn't you? Say, hey, wait a minute, you know, this person, I don't know if you'd say it this way or whatnot, this person can't help it. They are there. And yet, in theology, we've created this system whereas we can't help it. This is what we're born with. And we're sinners in the hands of an angry God. We allow God to put this judgment on something that really deserves more pity and prayer than it does judgment. So the Bible never speaks of a sin nature in ontological terms. By that I mean here's our very being, here's our very makeup, is our sin nature. So we might have a predisposition, and that predisposition, I would say, does have something to do with societal norms, with the environment of things around us. And obviously, you know, I mentioned homeschooling a moment ago and how your children will never sin, and with tongue in cheek. But the truth is, at the same time, why do people homeschool? Because they say, I don't really want that environment for my children. That environment is one that's not helpful for my children. It's harmful for my children. And so they pull their children out of that. So the influence of fallen world brings a predisposition, but a predisposition to sin is not even sin. Sin is willful, personal, moral. I think all of us have a predisposition towards some things. You know, some people really are predisposed to, let's say, addiction, maybe an alcohol addiction. And some people, because of, I think maybe even if their parents weren't alcoholics and their friends weren't alcoholics, you may be predisposed to that because of a certain DNA, the way you are. It just will lean that way. Some people will become an alcoholic really quickly. Okay, is that a sin that you're going to become an alcoholic? I mean, that you could easily become an alcoholic? No, that's not a sin. It's a predisposition that that is yours. The sin is when you personally, willfully, morally make this choice. Okay, I'm going to drink myself to death into a stupor and bring it there. So predisposition. Now, that, by the way, I think even gets into the argument of is a person born gay? I would say no, but also I would say, okay, even let's say they did find, okay, there's a gay gene. Well, a predisposition to that's like a predisposition to overeating, a predisposition to alcohol, whatever it is. The sin comes when it's personal, willful, and moral. Not because of influence or predisposition. And influence certainly can bring about a predisposition. And I think that this is one of the reasons, of course, why we want to have a home environment and a church environment and hopefully even a societal environment where the temptation is just not there all around us, waving us down. And it is a home and a church and a society in which there is a goodness that is about us. So sin is not something we are born with. It is something that we are accountable for. I think if we're born with sin, it really makes a hard argument to say that we're the ones responsible for that for which we are born. Now, let's talk about, notice I said on page 136 here, the transmission of sin, some theological models of transmission of sin. These are things I don't agree with. But theology says, here's how we got sin. I say we got sin by sinning. How's that? Revolutionary idea. I got it from the Bible. We got sin by sinning. We made a personal, willful, moral decision, and that was sin against the character of God. Theology has a couple of things. One they will call seminal headship. That is the idea that we were all in Adam genetically, and when Adam sinned, it changed his DNA. And therefore, that DNA, us being in him, we were personally responsible for what he did, and we inherited his guilt and his nature. Now, I think there are a lot of problems with that. Even what I think is somewhat of a silly idea that we were somehow present in Adam. But the seminal headship idea is we were there. And we were all a part of helping make the decision, kind of like in the David show last night where they had I don't know, what was that, video or something in the background where they had 10,000 warriors back there. We were there in the background, cheering them on. And therefore, we were as guilty as he is. I think you have to be a theologian to make something so stupid. But they did it. Federal headship is another one. Federal headship is not that we were in Adam. I mean, literally in Adam. Federal headship is that Adam made a decision that included all of us. And so he was our federal representative, if you will. And we are guilty because as our legal representative, his guilt imputed was imputed to all of humanity by some kind of covenant that God has made, a deal that he made with the devil that Adam had made. I think both models attempt to explain the universality of sin. What they're trying to do is say, how come everybody in this room sins? They're trying to explain that. Well, we sin because we have a sin nature. We sin because we were in Adam and we inherited. We sin because Adam sold us out to the devil as our legal representative, and now we're stuck with the legal agreement that he made. And I think they go beyond Scripture in making this up. So Adam, in the transmission of sin, Adam brought sin into human existence. But I'm going to say Adam and Adam alone was guilty for Adam's sin. Just like you, your family, you have a spouse that sins. Are you responsible for it? No. They're the ones that's responsible for it. You have a mom or a dad to sin. They're responsible. But what is sometimes passed down is the consequences of sin. So, as I said in harmatology, our problem ended up that we were outside of the garden. There's the consequence of sin. We're born outside of the garden. So sometimes I joke around a little bit. I say that I was born in Casper, Wyoming. People ask me, why were you born in Casper? I'll tell you, to be close to my mother. That's why I was born in Casper, to be close to my mother. I didn't really have a choice where I was born. It's just my mother happened to be there, and therefore I was born there. So we have some consequence to where our mother, where our father, where our society is. There's certainly some consequence to that, which, by the way, I think we also ought to, especially as people who have dominion, we ought to say, okay, what kind of decisions can I... Do I want to be a caveman for more than 5 years? What's the limit? Because there's going to be some consequences for generations that go down. Do I want this for our society? What kind of community do I want to give to the children and grandchildren that come to me? I ought to think about consequences of all my decisions. But it was consequence, not guilt. Even Romans chapter 5, verse 15, through the offense of one, many be dead. Okay, that's the consequence that comes. Through that offense of one, many be dead. So guilt requires agency. That is, guilt requires personal, volitional, moral decision. You made that, you are guilty. Now, you might be suffering the consequence in an inherited way. And certainly, I think when we talk about the transmission of sin, you and I suffer some consequences of sin. A lot of people. But our guilt, what are we charged for? That happens to be what we did. Now, you know, I say this, we'll prove some scripture here, but strangely enough, I don't know. I'll take a poll here. Does it kind of make sense that you're guilty for what you did, not what somebody else did? Yeah, that seems biblical, logical. But the strange thing is, in a seminary, this concept would be completely rejected. Because the seminaries all teach federal headship, seminal headship, inherited guilt, that sinful nature, original sin, total depravity. It is all so much of part of theological thinking that we kind of over time do begin to think, hey, I guess that's right. The preachers also, every preacher I ever had, you know, said this. But I think, again, if we go back to the Bible, it's not true. Let's look at some passages and see the bottom line here is that guilt requires a moral awareness. Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 39. Let's try that. I have this different keyboard, and I don't know what... Control A? Nope, that didn't do it. Oops, Nathan, I got it off. Tab? Eventually, it'll get back there. I got it. Now I forgot the passage. Deuteronomy what? 1:39. Why didn't you say so? Moreover, your little ones, which you said should be a prey, and your children, which in that day had no knowledge between good and evil, they shall... I don't know what to do here now. They shall go in thither. I forgot my mouse. But you get the point. Your children, which in that day had no knowledge. What it goes on to say is, they're not guilty. There'll be some consequences that are theirs. Your children had no knowledge of this, but they're going to have to go in there, and they're going to have to clean up your mess or live with your mess, is what the passage says there. Okay, let's go to Isaiah chapter 7, verse 16. Let's see if we can bring that about. I should bring my trackpad next time, shouldn't I? Isaiah Isaiah 7:16. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that thou abhorrest shall be forsaken of both her kings. Now, this is talking about a promised child, Isaiah 7. We kind of know that passage, right? A messianic passage. But here it's specifically talking about a child right then. Before the child shall know to refuse evil and choose the good. Okay, again, what is the point here? The point is moral discernment develops with age. The Bible teaches children don't know. They are not responsible for that which they do not know. Romans chapter 4, verse 15, where no law is, there is no transgression. Well, that one's kind of interesting. There's nothing to cross over if you haven't put something to cross over, right? Therefore, you get over in that territory, that's no problem. It's not until they put the fence up that we say, okay, now we have a problem here. There is a law. So you've got a moral awareness, a volition. I think these are just three passages of Scripture, but it goes down. So we've got a mortality condemnation, but infants who die, and infants sadly do die, but infants who die are not guilty. You know, Catholics, I may run across this later, but the original sin issue is that you have a biological problem. You were born guilty. It was transmitted to you through your parents, and you have Adam's guilt. That's original sin. Now, Catholics, that has to be overcome one way or another. Catholics overcome it by infant baptism. When you are baptized, that gives you the grace to have some time until your moral discernment has developed and you come to a point. Catholic baptism does not believe that this provides salvation once for all. What it does is get you to heaven for a short period of time. It buys you 8 years, okay? You get to go. I don't know what the year on Catholic is when you're supposed to take catechism. Does anybody? I mean, when you're confirmed, that's the word I'm trying to find.
It depends on the diocese.
Depends on the diocese, okay. Okay, 10, 12 years old, you come to the point where your diocese says, okay, we here now decree that beyond this point, your personal, moral, volitional sin. So we, by the way, and I know I've mentioned this once or twice, we get a lot of calls at the church. They're either salesmen or they're people wanting their babies baptized. Or people wanting money. Okay, we get three calls. That's the three calls we get. But we get an amazing number of calls of, hey, I just had a baby. Can you baptize my baby? And of course, it's a decent opportunity to say, well, let's talk here a little bit. Sadly, what I have found on that, I used to even have them come by and, and let's talk about salvation, baptism, and whatnot. And what I found is you come to the end and they say, so can you baptize my baby? So ingrained in, it's hard to get through there. But the reason they are worried about that is because they love their children. And their church told them they were born a sinner, they were born guilty, and if you're born guilty, there is a judgment to come to you. And so if this child dies, then that child is going to be damned forever. So, they want to do something about it. And so they... The reason they don't go to their own church is because the Catholics charge to baptize. They heard the Baptists give things away free. So, but by the way, I might also say that Reformed theology has the same problem. Calvinist theology has the same problem. Sometimes, by the way, a lot of Reformed theology, especially in the Lutheran and Presbyterian world, they do a lot of infant baptism. They read it a little differently, but it's the same way that brings them into the covenant. And so now they're one of the covenant people, and so now they're protected. But ultimately, the way they deal with it is Well, God has elected certain children not to be damned and other children to be damned. And so, you know, if you got the wrong one, too bad, so sad. Sorry about that. It's all to God's glory. Praise be unto Him. It's kind of a wicked theology, I think. I deal with it by saying your child is not born guilty. It's the saddest thing in the world to see a child die. But they are not guilty of anything. They had mortality because of their location. Couldn't get them to the tree of life, but they're going to be with the Lord. Pastor Bays is raising his hand. Ah, yeah. There is that idea that society, you know, society decides what's sinful, because that's biblical. And then society now, in the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years, has gotten into these original sins of society. They've sort of bought into it. And so slavery is the original sin for our society, and therefore we need to bring offerings in order to come to overcome a lot of theology that's been borrowed and then carried down through there. But I think what we've got is, if there is not a moral awareness, a volition, a personal, volitional, moral act, there is no guilt. Sin has not been translated. There's consequences from someone else's sin, but it's not there. So the literalist position, and I think we're close to the end here, page 141. Adam's sin brought judgment and death to all, but guilt remained his. It was his act, his choice, remained his. We inherit mortality. We inherit corruption. We inherit even, I'll say, a disposition, not dispensation, a disposition towards sin, because when one person sins, it gets easier for everybody, doesn't it? So we begin to find sin much easier than it used to be with a disposition. So that's what we inherit. But personal guilt arises only with a volitional transgression. So the literalist view is there is no inherited guilt. There's only inherited consequences. And God judges each man for his choice. Now, I put that passage, Ezekiel 18:20, although that is a millennial passage speaking of the future. The soul that sinneth, it shall die. And I probably shouldn't even have used the passage of Scripture there, because it's a little bit out of context, and we're biblical literalists, and we don't do things out of context there. Dan?
What do you do with the proverbial verse that if you look after a woman in lust, you're guilty of sin? Now, at that standard, if you're driving down the road and you wish you could drive 30 miles an hour faster, you're breaking the law by doing that. So how do you get around that? Because that will come up in conversation.
Yeah, it's time for a break. It is a good question that you have there. You know, if you look at a woman in sin and lust, whatever the word was used there in Matthew chapter, maybe it's not Matthew chapter 5. It's the Lord speaking anyway. And, look, you have sin. Or if you say to your brother, you know, thou fool, that one does come from Matthew chapter 5. Remember, that got Jimmy Carter in trouble. I don't know if you remember. Yes, his wife said he talks too much. That's right. I think Playboy magazine. His first mistake was probably being interviewed by Playboy magazine. But anyway, they ask him, you know, have you ever committed adultery? Well, I haven't. My heart. He just tried to teach a Sunday school lesson there, and it really didn't work out too well for him, although he did get elected. So, and the difference there between, boy, I wish I could drive 30 miles an hour faster than I'm driving right here. I suppose one of the things we could say is fast driving against the character of God?
If you're in danger.
He had a fast.
That speed limit is a societal thing.
Is Yeah, it is. I doubt that we are going to be judged for speeding when we get to heaven. He did institute human government. You get into a lot of issues there that, Dan, I'm not totally sure how to answer. How's that?
I'd rather have you say you can't answer it than just make something up.
Sometimes I do make stuff up, yes. Harold?
This is so integrated in Christianity, I'm having trouble coming that I was not born into sin and my nature is not sinful. But one of the greatest things I'm looking forward to in eternity, Randy, is not living in my head anymore and this stuff that's always there and that tension that Paul talks about in Romans 6 and 7 and 8, that he does the things he doesn't want to do, that just, to me, it's still, I am naturally a sinful person, and I want out of this by giving one day this new body that will just have perfect thoughts. Now, is that not my nature, and am I still going to struggle with this stuff with a new body?
A very good question. I do think, now this might be a little more, I think, that when we get to heaven and we have a perfect knowledge that is given to us, that it's going to erase a lot of the consequences of our sins and other sins that have been placed in there, like our stinking thinking, as who used to say that? Zig Ziglar. Oh, okay. You know, we get that thinking in there. And to have that freed, it's liberating, as we talk about here, to be freed from all that. But to ultimately get to heaven and have a completely new thinking that the old stuff has been passed away and all things become new will really become ultimately liberating, won't it? Because, yeah, I think we do, we struggle with it. You said that, and I was thinking about, you know, Everett, the typesetter over here, keeps telling us writers there is no need for two spaces after a period, that was old-fashioned, right? And you don't have to have two spaces after a period. And I keep saying, you can't tell a thumb that's been doing that for, you know, 50 years. It's gonna go twice. As a matter of fact, if you look at my computer right here, there is a spot on the space bar where the plastic has been worn through, because I hit it twice when I only need to hit it once, right? So we get some of this so ingrained in us, don't we, that it's almost like our fingerprint. You know, how in the world are we ever going to get that out of our system? Really hard to do. But heaven is a wonderful place. Yeah. I better let us take a break. Let's see, it's 3:06 now. Let's go about 20 minutes or so and get all the good stuff. By the way, who brought the Fig Newtons? You brought the Fig Newtons. Thank you. I like Fig Newtons. I can't afford Fig Newtons, so I never buy them. And I took the whole package to my room. I was like, these people don't need Fig Newtons. I need Fig Newtons. So I don't know if that's a sin or not. Roger? This next session will be the last session for today, yes.
Okay.
Salvation.